Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Tom McLeod, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 12th of July, these are our main stories. Anxiety in the US and NATO as the first parts of a state-of-the-art Russian-made missile defence system arrive in Turkey. We'll look at the implications. North Korea presents a new constitution naming Kim Jong-un as head of state. But what does that mean? And
they threw people in a river. They threw dead bodies in a river.
In Sudan, a BBC investigation suggests a brutal crackdown on pro-democracy protesters was ordered in advance by the highest levels of the military. Also in this podcast,
Chennai is a warning card to the global community. So if it's happening here, it can happen anywhere.
Should the rest of the world be learning lessons from the water crisis that's hitting one of India's largest cities? And how mother whales whisper to their calves, and why? We begin with Turkey, which has added one of the world's most powerful anti-aircraft weapons to its arsenal. The country's military said today that it has received parts for the Russian-made S-400 missile defence system, and it's already putting strain on Turkey's relationship with its NATO allies. Now, for months, Washington has warned of harsh sanctions on Turkey if the purchase of the S-400 went ahead. The US also threatened to cancel Turkey's purchase of American-made fighter jets. Today, NATO also said it was concerned about the potential consequences of the deal, adding that cooperation between its member states is fundamental. So I asked our diplomatic and defence correspondent Jonathan Marcus why this missile defence system has caused such concern.
The S-400 is an extremely sophisticated air defence system. Russia, following on from the Soviet Union, has real expertise in building these pieces of weaponry. The Turks want to, as they see it, plug a particular gap in their air defences. They argue that they have been denied Western equivalent weapon systems, or they argue those systems are not available under the same preferential terms and so on. So they insist they're going ahead with the S-400. The first crates, the first bits and pieces for the system, we're told, have arrived in Turkey. The Americans have all the time been saying, if you get this missile, you cannot buy our advanced F-35 warplanes. They've suspended pilot training in America. They've suspended the training of mechanics. The first couple of aircraft that have been kind of delivered to the Turks but are still in the United States are not going to be handed over to Turkey. They're threatening, as you say, sanctions. They're threatening to suspend the purchase altogether. And remember, Turkey is also a partner in the programme. Its aviation industry manufactures many of the parts for the aircraft. It's destined to be a regional hub for the servicing of the aircraft's engines. All of that now is potentially in jeopardy. So in the wider sense, it's a fundamental, this isn't a row just over particular weapons. It's a row over Turkey's strategic direction and where it really stands in the Atlantic Alliance.
But what is America particularly worried about? You've outlined the threats that they've made to Turkey. Are they worried about losing income from financial investment in their own weapons from Turkey, or are they worried about the possible technology transfers with Russia?
Well, the technology transfer is the most important one. There are several issues. They are concerned that if Russian technicians are in Turkey helping to set up the radar system, if the F-35 is operating in close proximity in the same airspace, there will be information passed to the Russians, inevitably, which will enable them to better track the aircraft. This is, after all, remember, a stealth aircraft, but no aircraft is invisible to radar, and the more the Russians can find out about it, the better perhaps they might be able to deal with it in any future contingency. Also, of course, air defence systems are a whole. It's an assemblage of many different radars and missiles operating at different ranges, different altitudes. You've got to be able to plug these systems into each other. And as far as NATO is concerned, you can't plug the S-400 into NATO's and Turkey's wider air defence system. So that's a problem. But as I say, at root, it's also a question about where Turkey really stands. Is it a reliable NATO ally? What do the tensions between Ankara and Washington really amount to?
That was our diplomatic and defence correspondent Jonathan Marcus speaking to me a bit earlier. Now, moving on to Kim Jong-un. He's been the supreme leader of North Korea since 2011, but it turns out that he's not actually been the country's head of state. Now, though, North Korea has unveiled a revised constitution in which Kim is formally named in that role. Before the change, the president of parliament had held the position. This move is being seen as an attempt by Kim to consolidate power. Our reporter in Seoul, Hyung-un Kim, explains why.
This is the eighth year since the young leader came to power. So basically, he's cementing his authority in the regime. So we know that he's been the supreme leader of North Korea and recently revised and revealed constitution is now saying that he's the head of state. Basically, what this means is that we will likely be seeing more of him in international diplomacy. We know that he met with President Trump of U.S., Putin of Russia, Xi Jinping of China, and Moon Jae-in of South Korea. So basically, many experts are saying that the latest move is trying to cement his authority and trying to show off that he's the head of the state of a quote-unquote normal state. Basically, internationally traditional ruling style they're trying to show.
And interesting that you bring up his other meetings with world leaders there. Do you think that that is a genuine opening up by Kim Jong-un, or do those other leaders have to be a bit wary of these moves?
Well, many of the North Korean defectors that I've talked to are saying that North Korea is unlikely to give up its nuclear weapons. Actually, in the constitution that's recently unveiled, they refer to themselves as nuclear power state. They have been doing so for a long time, and they haven't changed that or they haven't removed that word. So they have no intentions of removing nuclear weapons, many experts say. However, they are trying to open doors to foreign investment because they want to boost trade. And this is also evident in the recently revised and revealed constitution. The two words that's evident here is information and science and technology. Kim Jong-un has been trying to boost these sectors and hopefully turn around the economy with this. But also this leads to nuclear because science and technology, many of the experts that we've talked to, is about nuclear capabilities. But they do want to open up to boost their economy.
Hyun-un Kim there speaking to me from Seoul. Turning our attention to Sudan, the BBC has uncovered evidence suggesting that the attack on protesters in the country on June the 3rd was ordered from the top and planned in advance. The internet is now operating again in the country, so a flood of footage has suddenly emerged. BBC Africa Eye analysed over 300 mobile phone videos that were shot in Khartoum that morning and pieced them together into a detailed account of a massacre in which dozens of people were killed. Mohanad Hashim has more. And this report has some graphic details.
In the desert outside of Khartoum, Sudanese soldiers prepare for an attack. Footage seen by BBC Africa Eye shows forces stood upon tanks in sand-colored fatigues gathering in the desert while peaceful protesters line the streets of the capital. These are the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group under the command of Sudan's army. They have been used to suppress uprisings in the past. Many of their fighters came from the feared Janjaweed militias, who are accused of genocidal atrocities in Darfur. What followed in Khartoum at dawn on Monday the 3rd of June was a violent clampdown on the peaceful protest. Through social media, protesters revealed the horrific sights and sounds of the attack, uploading their accounts as the attack happened.
No one can bear such a beating. Please forgive us if we die. Forgive us that we could not run anymore. Stay together for this country. Hold together for this country.
BBC Africa Eye have verified footage showing civilians shot at close range by men clearly wearing RSF uniforms and beaten even when they showed no resistance. Women were not spared. Medical staff treating the wounded also came under attack. One doctor was shot in the grounds of his own hospital. An hour later, the sit-in had been cleared, and this was always the plan. The BBC has now spoken to two men who say they are serving RSF officers and admit to having participated in the attack. Both men claim the orders to break the sit-in were issued almost 2 weeks in advance. We have used actors' voices to protect their identities for fear of repercussion.
We received these orders from the Commander General Hemeti. We received these instructions on the 20th. After that, Abdulrahim Degalo came to see us and he told us to clear this sit-in because these people have to be made to flee.
Abdulrahim Degalo is the brother of a man known as Hemeti, General Muhammad Hamdan Degalo. He is the leader of the RSF and currently the deputy of Sudan's ruling military council. But many believe he is really the most powerful man in the country. Facing international condemnation following the attacks, Hemeti has denied responsibility for the killings of June the 3rd, blaming the violence on imposters and rogue elements.
Any man can say that he is with the RSF. The khaki of the RSF can be bought in the market. Before the breakup of the sit-in, we arrested some groupies, officers and individuals who are claiming to be from the RSF. Those are not from the RSF.
We have not received any response to our requests for a comment. Since the massacre, reports emerged from survivors of what happened to those who were killed.
They threw people in a river. They threw dead bodies in a river.
BBC Africa Eye has received corroboratory videos of bodies with concrete blocks still tied to their feet after having been pulled from the River Nile. A deal has now been struck, but still, video after video of this brutal repression flood in. The question is, will anyone be held accountable?
That was Mohanad Hashim reporting. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. A reminder that every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and Charles Haviland joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
For 18 years, Afghans have reeled under the Taliban insurrection. Thousands upon thousands have died. But could some new talks in Qatar be providing a chink of light at the end of the tunnel of war? In Turkey, President Erdogan sacks his central bank chief and takes a risk with missiles. I'll be asking why. The British ambassador is forced out by President Trump's very personal rage against him. A top US financier is charged with running a paedophile sex racket. We'll hear from my colleague who thinks the internet is now effectively a religion, and from another who's most upset about the cricket.
Thanks, Charles. That's all in The World This Week. It's broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays, and it's available to download from our website, which is bbc.co.uk/programmes. In the meantime, still to come in this podcast.
They are so forward-looking despite the trauma, despite the horrors they endured during their time away from their families. They're back in school and they're approaching their education with a joyfulness that might surprise a lot of people.
More than 5 years after they were kidnapped by radical Islamists, how are the Chibok girls coping with everyday life and liberty? Back to the US now, though. President Donald Trump has declared an emergency in the state of Louisiana as local residents brace for a possible hurricane. As we record this podcast, Tropical Storm Barry is just hours away from the coast, and meteorologists have said it could bring with it 48 hours of continuous rain. LaToya Cantrell is the mayor of New Orleans, that is Louisiana's largest city.
While it is uncertain what the impact will be, we will be affected. And we need to be prepared, and we are prepared to respond. This doesn't just mean the city of New Orleans by itself. It means all of our residents as well.
And all of those residents have been warned to seek shelter or even leave the city. Sophie Long has this report from New Orleans.
The streets of New Orleans were turned into rivers by the thunderstorms and flash floods of Barry's warm-up act. A state of emergency across Louisiana is already in effect as people await the main event. As the storm creeps towards the coast, it is growing in intensity. Forecasters fear it could reach hurricane strength just in time to strike land late Friday or early on Saturday. Residents of New Orleans, who are no strangers to storms or hurricanes, are making the relevant preparations, stocking up on water and emergency supplies. The main concern is the already swollen Mississippi River. If a storm surge predicted to move up from the Gulf of Mexico pushes water levels over 20 feet, it could overwhelm the levees protecting the city. People here know what the consequences of that could be. No one has forgotten the devastation left by Hurricane Katrina in 2005, which claimed more than 1,800 lives. As officials warn of extreme rain and flooding, people across Louisiana brace themselves for the first Atlantic hurricane of 2019.
That was Sophie Long in New Orleans as Storm Barry approaches. Now, shortly before we came into the studio, a train carrying millions of litres of water arrived in the southern Indian city of Chennai, which is facing a severe drought. Millions of people there are struggling as the city's four biggest reservoirs have virtually run dry. This shortage has even forced some schools to shut and companies to ask employees to work from home. The monsoon rains, which the city relies on, were light last year, and environmentalists blame climate change too, but urbanisation is also playing a part. Just before the arrival of that water train, our South Asia correspondent Rajini Vaidyanathan sent this report on the city's plight.
In the brutal afternoon heat, a group of people have just rushed out onto the street in the Ayanavaram area of Chennai. A large blue water tank has just arrived, and no one's wasting time. Women in saris are clutching brightly coloured plastic pots as they frantically fill them up with water. It's a scramble as people jostle and shove to get their hands on one of the two hoses connected to the lorry. In the crowd, a woman wearing a blue floral sari is arguing with a man over who should get water first as they both try to grab the pipe. Her name is Valamurthy, a 60-year-old widow. As she balances containers full of water, she takes me to her house close by.
Until we get more water, these fights will continue. One lorry load is not enough for all of us.
It's estimated that millions of people here in Chennai are now relying on supplies from trucks as the taps have run dry. Yet this is one of India's largest and richest cities.
Chennai is big. It always used to have water. Now there's nothing. There is no water to drink, to wash clothes, no water to cook with. We can only take a bath every 2 or 3 days. If this is the situation, how can people live?
For us, water does not come magically out of nowhere. It needs to come from lakes and the ponds.
Arun Krishnamurthy is an environmentalist based in Chennai.
Chennai is a warning card to the global community. So if it's happening here, it can happen anywhere.
Almost all of Chennai's reservoirs have now run dry. Arun blames climate change for the erratic weather patterns and drought. But he also warns that the number of lakes and ponds, which store and collect rainwater, has drastically dwindled.
Taking over these water bodies to build commercial and residential properties has definitely had its impact with regards to how much water can we conserve and how much water is there for the population that is dependent on it.
Back in Ayanavaram, the water truck's almost empty for the day. What makes this situation even more dire is that India's currently in the middle of a heat wave. Gauri, a mother of two, says now she'll never take water for granted.
We used to use water without thinking about it. Now we have a water shortage and we regret it. Water is more precious than food and gold. God has to bring the rain. Only that can save us.
That was Gauri there, a resident of the city of Chennai, ending that report by Rajini Vaidyanathan. Now, one mid-April night in 2014, hundreds of Boko Haram fighters descended on the town of Chibok, which is in northeastern Nigeria. The Islamists ransacked the town, then seized 276 girl students from a government school and drove them deep into the Sambisa forest. What happened next is covered in a new book by the journalist Aisha Cisse. She stayed with those girls who were released or escaped and tells their stories. And her book is called Beneath the Tamarind Tree. Shaima Khalil asked her how willing the girls were to talk about this ordeal.
One of the things that surprised me as I pulled this book together and spoke to some of them was just how open they are and how they are so forward-looking despite the trauma, despite the horrors they endured during their time away from their families. They're back in school and they're approaching their education with a joyfulness that might surprise a lot of people.
What have they been telling you, or some of them have been telling you, about the experiences they went through?
Years of terror from fears that they may die in aerial bombardments conducted by the Nigerian government. Several of them were injured, you know, in those campaigns and have been left with injuries that they're still overcoming. And then there were the beatings, there was the starvation, there was the constant movement, they were sleeping out in the elements, there was the pressure to marry their captors, which was constant. There was also this constant pressure to break them, to convert to Islam, because the majority of the girls who were taken are actually Christian. And that surprised me, that it wasn't enough for Boko Haram just to have taken them away from their loved ones to confine them, but they also were intent on breaking their spirit, breaking their faith, and converting them to Islam. There was a kind of systematic terror that went with their captivity.
Surely with these experiences that you've described, the shadow of Boko Haram kind of hangs over their lives.
Yeah, and you know, to be clear, the shadow is not just one from the psychological terror. There's a very real world terror, because Boko Haram continues to terrorize Chibok. The attacks have been happening in recent weeks to the point where several of the girls who were taken, I was told just a few days ago, their parents have lost their homes in attacks. They've been razed to the ground, not just because they're Chibok girls. They're not targeting them per se, but the area is still under siege. So there's still that. And then, yes, you're absolutely right. The memories, the PTSD that you would expect from spending so much time in captivity, you know, has led to, you know, spontaneous crying, nightmares, despondency, everything that would come with such an ordeal. All of this they are fighting to overcome.
You were the only journalist to accompany 21 of the girls back home. Tell me how welcoming the community was for those girls who returned.
They had seen their parents when they'd been released a few weeks earlier, but they hadn't met their wider families since they had come home, if you will. So it was just absolutely joyful. But at the same time, I should say, somehow the Nigerian military had passed the message on to the community that the girls were coming home, and some of the other families had thought that their children had been released too. So in that same meeting space, there were these mothers anxiously awaiting the return of their daughters who were still in captivity. And it was during these reunions that they discovered that their children weren't free. And so amongst all this joy and laughter, there was also the most awful crying that I've ever heard in my entire life.
That was the journalist and author Aisha Cisse speaking there to Shaima Khalil. Now, southern right whales, they're among the largest sea animals in the world, and they apparently live complex social lives. A new study has found that females from the species whisper to their calves so that they can avoid being overheard by predators. Terry Egan has this report.
The sound of southern right whales off Western Australia, where they go to breed. But the calves, even when up to 8 metres long, are vulnerable to attack by killer whales. To avoid them, the mothers, as well as their calves, frequently strive to hide from predators by gravitating toward cloudy water. The loss of visual contact that follows, though, could oblige them to call to one another, increasing the risk of attracting attention.
So they try not to. Even that sound you heard at the top of this piece might be too loud. Approaching them stealthily off the southern tip of Western Australia, researchers from Denmark and Hawaii attached sound recording tags to the youngsters and to their mothers in the hope of recording the pair's interactions. They found the animals were producing two types of call, a grunt and a mooing sound. But instead of communicating continuously, the researchers discovered, the mother and calf called less than once per dive. And when the researchers analysed the volume of the animals' calls, they were surprised by how quiet those moos and grunts were. According to their study, the pounding waves drowned out the calls within a few hundred metres, making it difficult for killer whales to eavesdrop on the soft conversations. Just another way to avoid attracting unwanted attention.
Terry Egan there reporting on some interesting whale noises. Now, we come to the final part of our podcast, where we tell you about a few lesser reported stories from around the world. And with me in the studio to do so is Crassie Twigg from BBC Monitoring, who follow local news in many languages. So Crassie, let's start with anger in Bulgaria because of pictures of dead dolphins on beaches being posted on Facebook, some of them missing heads and tails. Do we actually know what's happened to them?
Well, that depends on who you ask. Environmentalists have been particularly vocal in their anger. They claim that the dolphins are victims of illegal turbot fishing, which is very profitable business, and it's subject to catch limits by the EU as well as whole periods of ban on fishing. So activists say that one species, the Black Sea harbour porpoise, is particularly vulnerable to gill nets that apparently stretch for hundreds of kilometres deep inside the Black Sea. It's because they're smaller in size than other dolphins, they get caught in the eyes of the nets where they suffocate, and fishermen later cut them off to free the nets. The authorities are not very happy with that explanation. They say they haven't seen evidence of human intervention and say there are all kinds of other natural factors at play, such as disease, for example.
But these are protected species, correct?
Absolutely. There are concerns about declining numbers of dolphins as well as the turbot. And by the way, this has been happening for many years now, every summer for quite a few years. And ecologists fear that if nothing is done to stop this alleged poaching, several more years of this will put paid to the species.
It's a shame. Moving on to your next story, it's about software. It's designed to teach ideology. I wonder where that could be.
Where could that be? North Korea, of course. It's called Cheongso 1.0. Wait for it. Designers are already working on the next version, which is Cheongso 2.0, with added function of voice reading. This has been described as an encyclopedia-like program which aggregates classical works and anecdotes about the founding father Kim Il-sung, his son Kim Jong-il, and the current leader Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un, the millennial leader, who has also been described as a computer whiz, has overseen a rapid growth in the use of IT. Did you know there are about 5 million mobile phone users in North Korea?
No, that really surprised me. I didn't know that.
And that is 20% of the country's population. There's been a lot of focus on ideology lately. The anniversary of Kim Il-sung's death was a few days ago. But it's also part of a wider effort by the government to counter foreign influence. So we've seen foreign news and drama from South Korea, particularly entering the country on mobile devices like USB sticks. So the North Korean approach has been, instead of blocking technology, they're embracing it. But they're doing it in a way to push the communist state's version of reality to the people.
And sounds similar to things that happen in China as well, that particular method of yes. Ideology. Talking about versions of reality, next you have a story that proves, once again, not everything is quite what it seems on Instagram. This one is quite funny.
It is my favourite story of the week. Let me show you the pictures. So we're looking at sand beaches, beautiful turquoise waters.
Yeah.
You know, a version of a tropical paradise.
People swimming, yes. People getting married next yeah. to this, as you said, blue-watered lake, having lots of fun. It looks idyllic.
Absolutely. And you'd be very surprised, this is in Siberia. In fact, it has been called Novosibirsk Maldives. Very surprising. So this lake is not what it seems. It's a lake near the Russian city of Novosibirsk, which has been attracting loads of Instagrammers because of the striking color of the lake. But the lake is not what it seems. It's a man-made ash dump. for a nearby power plant. And it is full with chemicals. In fact, the authorities of the plant were alarmed by so many people flocking to take selfies and swim in it that they have issued the health warning saying, do not touch the waters. The waters are actually full of metal oxides.
And that's why it's this amazing colour.
And that is why it's this amazing neon colour.
But still, as with social media, people are flocking to it.
Absolutely. From what we could see from comments on social media, the warning hasn't put off visitors in pursuit of a good selfie.
Oh, dear. Crassy Twig, thank you very much indeed for bringing us some of those lesser discovered news stories from the BBC monitoring team. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast a bit later on. If you do want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Tom McLeod, and until next time, goodbye.
That's me drinking millions of viruses.
Crowd Science is the podcast that takes your questions and turns them into audio adventures.
My question for Crowd Science is, why and when did humans first start cooking food?
It's all fire!
I'm Marnie Chesterton, and each week we put your questions to scientists working at the limits of human knowledge.
I wanted to know how cells... how do they know what to do?
They're yanking on their neighbours, they're pushing on their neighbours.
We also try and demonstrate exactly what they're telling us.
What are the limits of human endurance?
You've just run a marathon and been hit by a car. How are you?
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
So if you'd like to inject a bit more science into that...
just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew it! Amazing!
A good night's sleep is going extinct. The rise of tech and stress in the modern world is keeping people awake. Some are even turning to cat memes to get them through the night. IKEA is here to help with everything you need to build up your rest reserves. Stylish bedding, supportive mattresses, and unique bed frames. So you can stop cat memeing and start cat napping. See what I did there? Discover new ways to save your sleep today.